It is indeed. A very good evening from Damien O'Mara. You're very welcome to the Thursday edition of Game On. Busy programme to come between now and 7 o'clock. Coming up shortly, ahead of what is a landmark night for the Camogie Association, Waterford's Niamh Rocket will join us as delegates prepare to vote on the issue of skorts versus shorts. A really interesting conversation. We'll bring you that in just a couple of moments' time. Keith Tracy's going to be with me to look back on last night's relative non-event in the Europa League final. We'll have Shep with his eye on America, and we will be chatting about Stage 2 of the Ross Tolchin and that great institution of Irish sport in the company of Shane Stokes. 51552 is our number if you'd like to make contact with us, or you can find us across social media at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
It certainly is. Keith Tracy, how are you?
I'm good, Damo. How are you?
Not too bad. I went home last night. I sat down. I had myself all ready as a neutral to enjoy the Europa League final. And let's be very honest, it was 2 hours of my life I will never get back.
Yeah, it was fairly poor. I thought as a neutral, I thought all I want to do is see these two teams rip into each other, a million defensive mistakes, a load of goals. And yeah, it seemed like both teams just froze. The ball spent an awful lot of time in the middle of the pitch. An awful lot of players were on the ground. There was no rhythm, no flow to the game whatsoever. But I don't think any Spurs fans will care anyway, that as long as they won the trophy, which they obviously have done.
We're going to get stuck into it in much more detail later in the programme. But like, we always talk about finals are strange things because there's so much at stake, and very often we delude ourselves by thinking they're going to be brilliant culminations to competitions. But the two teams, 16th against 17th in the Premier League, like, realistically, it was always going to look like it was either going to end up in a catastrophe of errors, which made it really exciting, or it's going to be like watching paint dry.
Yeah, I didn't think either team were strong enough defensively to keep a clean sheet. And like I said, I thought there would be a whole host of defensive mistakes that would allow the opposition in to score. And you look at the second half, Spurs XG was 0.00. You know, I think they'd had 20% of the ball. They just went out, bit down on the gum shield and said, look, we've got our noses in front and United aren't going to score. And I think an awful lot of the Manchester United players, the starting 11 in particular, didn't really come to the party. And when you've got so many passengers in a European final, it really is an uphill battle.
It's a great night though for Ange, after all he's had to endure over the course of the season.
Yeah, it is. And I was asked this question yesterday as an Arsenal fan, who do you want to win this final? And I actually lean towards Spurs, believe it or not. And that's a strange thing for an Arsenal fan to say. And it's basically just because of Ange Postecoglou. When he first came into Spurs, his interviews were brilliant. He was hanging on his every word. He was very light and airy. And I just thought he brought a little bit of the cheeky chappy to it. And I enjoyed all of his interviews. But over the last maybe 2 months, maybe a little bit more, he's become extremely prickly in his interviews, and it's like he doesn't want to engage in the whole clown and hero debate.
But is he's entitled to fight back at stuff like that?
Not when you're sitting 16th in the Premier League. And I know, you know, it's a European competition. You know, they've got a backdoor into the Champions League. But, you know, a lot of people, and I'm sure they're trying to poke me as an Arsenal fan, saying Spurs have had a better season than Arsenal.
But they haven't.
Let's not go down that road. I mean, you could sit here and say Nottingham Forest have had a better season than Spurs. Yes, Spurs are in the Champions League. Fair play to them. They got a backdoor in there. But when you lose 21 games out of a 38-game season, you know, you don't have an awful lot of room to play with.
When you look at the two clubs this year, and like, there was as much focus on the two managers last night as there was on the players themselves. How much of Spurs' travails this year are down to Ange, and how much of United's problems are down to Ruben Amorim?
Well, there's a question. I think Ange has evolved a little bit. I think they went a little bit more back to front over the last few months, and you could say, you know, that's down to injuries as well. The one thing, I look at Manchester United and I just don't see that 3-4-3 happening. I think they're too weak in the centre of the pitch. Casemiro and Bruno Fernandes, when they don't have the ball, there's very little they bring to the game. And you look at Bruno Fernandes yesterday, out of possession, absolutely non-eventful. And when he had the ball, Manchester United fans are telling me he's one of the best players in the world, one of the best playmakers in the world. He didn't come to the party last night, and look, so often he hasn't done within the Premier League. So I think they've got an awful lot of liabilities, and I think Manchester United are at a crossroads that Arsenal were at a couple of years ago when Mikel Arteta got rid of Aubameyang, and a lot of Arsenal fans weren't happy because he was the best player, highest goal scorer, but he wasn't a good professional. So Arteta bit down and just said, look, you're out, for the greater good of the club. And a lot of United fans, I think, are on board now with Bruno Fernandes leaving to fund the rebuild of the club.
Okay, you're going to stay with us. A couple of stories making the headlines over the course of the day. Aoife Wafer, a guest on the programme last night, Andrew asked her about a proposed move to Harlequins. She dodged it like a winger rather than a back row forward, but that move to Harlequins has been confirmed today. Munster have confirmed that they will play one of their Investec Champions Cup ties in Páirc Uí Chaoimh later on in December. And a story we might come back to with Keith later in the programme. Athlone Town, who are really struggling, the bottom of the First Division, have released five players from the club, which is unusual in the middle of a season, but it's equally unusual when you look at the names: Adam Wickstead, Declan McDade, Kyle O'Connor, J.R. Wilson and Bastian Airy. So it's an interesting situation in Athlone. So more of that to come. We're in a situation, it's approaching 10 past 6 of a Thursday evening, and probably the most notable story of the day is yet to come. And normally when that's the case, it revolves around a match or it revolves around some live event which is going to take place in the hours to come. But for us, the big event of the evening is going to take place at Croke Park.
Game on. Camogie.
And it is with Camogie we start on the programme this evening. What could well be a landmark day, a landmark evening in the history of the sport could play out at Croke Park this evening. The Camogie Association holding their special congress, which will see a vote put to delegates around the wearing of the skort or the player's preference, which is the use of shorts. So a big night ahead. Waterford player Niamh Rockett is with us. Niamh, how are you?
Hi, Damien. Good, and you?
Not too bad at all. Thanks so much for being with us. I know... we'll talk about the games at the weekend because the championship is getting underway, and I know that is what most people would like to be the focus this week. But like, it is a landmark night, and let's be very honest, it's an evening where nobody with certainty can say how they think things are going to play out at Croke Park this evening.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose when you're looking at how far we've come in the last couple of weeks, and the publicity and the media that has come around the skorts versus shorts issue, you'd be hoping that common sense would prevail, and you know that they give the players and the general public what the outcome that you all want, I suppose.
But the issue for me is there's been overwhelming support for the players from what I can see. There's been very few people have come out to criticise the playing base. But how then are we in a situation where nobody can say with confidence that this vote is going to go to give players the option of shorts over skorts?
Look, to be honest with you, after the first protest, I suppose, with Kilkenny and Dublin and the media that got around that, I suppose there was more pressure on the Camogie Association to make decisions. They initially said that they were going to go to 2026 Congress and bring it forward, and then the players still weren't happy with it. So although it looks like a player power, there's been 15 chances for the Camogie Association and the GPA to work to try get this issue resolved without doing protests. But just for ourselves, from a Water perspective, like, we thought that common sense would prevail, and that we would get to play our Munster final there 2 weeks ago, and that was cancelled at 8 o'clock or 8:30 the night before the match. So it was 14 hours before our match. So although you think that, you would hope that the pressure would come on and that the decision would be a good outcome, you never really know. I suppose we're the same. We had thought all week that we'd get to play Munster final, and that got abandoned. So you just hope that when it really matters, I suppose, that although we got to miss our match, there's a bigger picture here, and we want to hope that to give the choice to all the girls around the world.
Are you confident that it will go in the players' favour tonight?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm confident. I'd say I'm hopeful. I'd say that as opposed to any of the last Congress that have happened, I'm more hopeful than what I have been than ever before. But at the end of the day, I won't be saying that I'm happy or that I'm confident or I'm overwhelmingly satisfied until I know that it's definitely gone through, I suppose, tonight.
But what message will that send to players if this is rejected by delegates tonight?
The players, I suppose, like, there's been a lot taken away from us as players the last couple of weeks between matches and controversy surrounding big games like the Leinster final last weekend, the Munster final the week before. And it's a lot of pressure putting on players that are just trying to concentrate to play Camogie at the time. You see the men's Munster Championship is going ahead, the Leinster Championship, Joe, they're all concentrating on just hurling at the moment, and we're trying to worry about, are we allowed to wear shorts or skorts when we play in a match, you know? It's very, very frustrating. So I can only imagine if it doesn't go in the players' favour, that there would be some more protest or just, I suppose, general just outrage, I suppose, amongst the players anyway. And I think it's fair to say that the public, the general public, are backing the players as well.
Have you had any opposition?
Not really, no. I suppose we haven't had that much opposition. I suppose it's just traditionalist, but and people wanting to keep the tradition of it. And I think it's very unfair that there's so many players and ex-players and whatnot have come out and said that they don't mind skirts or they prefer shorts, etc. But there's been very little of the people who actually voted at the Congress and the delegates have come out in public and gave their reason for voting for it, which is phenomenally frustrating from a player's perspective. It just looks like it's all one side and that how can't it go through? But the people are actually voting at the top. I suppose they haven't come out and said that yet. So you're just hoping that they would, whether they have second thoughts on it or that they've changed their mind on it. You just hope that they would do the common sense thing tonight.
How damaging would it be for the sport overall if this is rejected?
Look, to be honest with you, it's quite upsetting myself. Like, I've played camogie, inter-county camogie for the last 16 years, and it's been quite upsetting to be going out in the media and I suppose going against the game that I've played for so long and going against the game I've loved for so long. But the game needs to move on and it needs to be more modernized, and we need to get as many players as we can to play the game. And if one player doesn't want to play because she doesn't like the feel of the shorts or the skirts, whatever the case is, that's one player too many. I see as a PE teacher myself how clothing can affect participation in sports. So it's something that I suppose a really a topic close to my heart. So I don't want to. I hope that it would prevail, but I don't want our sport to be known as just this backwards traditionalist sport that doesn't want to move with it. Like, I want us to be the fastest game in the world, like the men's hurling game, and for it to be recognised and recognised for the skill it is and not for the controversy surrounding it.
And the frustration is that we should be talking on programmes like this about provincial championships, about the All-Ireland series getting underway. In 2025, there's an awful lot of people would feel we should be beyond the point where we're talking about players living in fear of what pictures will be taken at a match, or players just simply physically feeling uncomfortable doing it, what it is they love to do so much.
Yeah, look, and I suppose only for the GPA have done phenomenal work. Gemma and Tom Parsons, John Begley and Tom Parsons in particular, in supporting the players the last couple of weeks and really trying to drive home the fact that the players aren't happy with the skirts at the moment. They did a survey, they've put together papers, they've tried to work with the Camogie Association, and they just want to give the players the choice to do it. They see the need for it. We're trying to promote sports, we're trying to promote women in sports, and we're trying to promote, I suppose, participation and females playing sports. So we're trying not to inhibit as much we can, and I suppose that's the overriding message in amongst all is give people a chance so we can get more people to play and we can promote our sport.
There's been an argument made that, with the swipe of a pen, the powers that be could have, hastened this decision along the way, or could have helped somewhere along the way. That's one argument. The other argument is that the association has a structure and you have to allow special congress to take place. You have to allow the democratic process to take place. Do you understand that, or do you feel more could have been done to stop this developing into what it has developed into?
I see the sides, both sides, because there has to be rules, and without rules, there's no games and there's no boundaries for games and procedures, etc. That's in every walk of life, in sports, jobs, etc. But on the other hand, I know that the GPA had put out the hand to try to contact association to work, Camogie Association to work together to try to come to some sort of happy medium or some way, and we can actually, I suppose, work together to try get this over the line. And then again, before when they released the paper 2 weeks before the initial or the week before the initial process, again they tried to do the same thing again, and it was ignored by the Camogie Association. So then you have a lot of angry players and frustrated players that aren't being heard and aren't being listened to, and then that just causes all sorts of controversy. I know from our own self anyway, like, we make a stand because we're I suppose Cork and Waterford, we're just sick of it not being just not being heard. And even the statement that was came out with, that in the interest of players, like, you're cancelling the game 16 hours before the match, and in the interest of players, and it'll be postponed. You're looking at our calendar. We've a bye this weekend. We're into 2 weeks of a game. Then we've 1 weekend off. And there's talks of the game that once finally played in that 1 weekend off. If that's the case, when we reach a quarter final, we're playing 6 weeks in a row. And if they defer it to the week after the quarterfinal into the middle of June, then we will be playing 4 to 5 weeks in a row, depending if you make a quarterfinal or not, which is not feasible at all. Like, you hear the men's games given out about playing 2 weeks in a row, never mind, say, or 6 day turnaround, never mind, say, 6 weeks in a row or 4 weeks in a row. And I suppose they knew that when the game was pulled. So, like, it's very, very frustrating. And I understand that there has to be rules and there has to be processes, but, like, to protect your sport and protect the, like, your sport and to preserve what's left of it and to try work with the players, there can be some sort of leniency in some ways as well.
When you look at situations like this, and like you've been at the forefront of the game for a number of years at this stage, like the notion of integration of the associations by 2027, do situations like this or events like this becoming so significant, does that dishearten you with regard to how likely that integration is?
Definitely disheartens me. Yeah, like, I came up from a household of equality in the household. So, like, my brother played for Waterford Hurling and my father played for Waterford Hurling and he played for Waterford football as well. And like, I went to the football training, so I didn't see any inequality in it because I just presumed that everyone would get the same till I started playing myself. And then when I started playing myself and my brother started seeing what was going on, because he was obviously to the forefront and surrounded by it in the environment that we were in, he just couldn't believe it and I couldn't believe it myself. But we're at home and I have my niece and nephews, and they don't think, you ask them who their favorite player is, they could name out a female player or a male player, it doesn't really matter. It could be David Clifford in football or it could be Beck Hart in camogie, and it's not about the sport. But you'd hope that the way today's society is, it'll move with it into integration. But when there's all this controversy surrounding the sport, it's not been shown the sport in the best light. And that's, I suppose, what's disheartening for the players' perspective and also the Camogie Association. I think it's very degree it's very I suppose it's very disheartening for both sides in that sense.
But then, like, has there been enough vocal support from the men's game?
Look, like, you can't, I suppose they're in the middle of championship as well, and like, they're, I suppose, looking after their own house and they're trying to, I suppose, to focus on their championship. Like, the other teams are in our champ in our Camogie Association. There's only a few teams that will actually really speak up and stand up for what's right. And I suppose if it doesn't affect you, then it's very hard to see it from that perspective. I know Conor Myler does massive research in that. He works with Aoife Lane and did a massive research in players and sports, and he's not afraid to actually come out and talk about it as a male intercounty player. But if more people started talking about it, then the more recognition it'll get. You see how the media spiral off of this protest. The more people talk about it and the power of social media, it can really get a buzz going. We wouldn't have had this special congregation only for the media and the spiral of it from the Dublin Kilkenny games. So the more men that talk about it, the better it will be for us,
Okay. So 7:30, we know Congress starts at. Ultimately, I don't think anyone really knows what time we're going to have a result at, because these debates and these conversations can tend to go on for quite some time. But you do have the prospect tonight that you and the Waterford panel are training, and you're waiting for someone's phone to go off on a sideline somewhere to let you know how this has gone.
Yeah. Look, I hope so. Yeah, like, and you hope that we would get a positive outcome. We'll all be training anyway this evening, and I know there's some teams that are playing this weekend, and you hope that they're just coming out of their training out tonight and saying, yeah, look, we're all aboard for short Saturday, and it'll all be, we're all steam full steam ahead. And I suppose they don't want it to go against them, because now we're into a situation where they're, do you wear the skirts, you wear the shorts, you stand up for what's right or not.
Yeah, and I presume if it's not passed tonight, there will be some form of a protest at the weekend.
I presume so, like, and I suppose it's very hard on those players now that are playing again the weekend, but I suppose we have to cross that bridge when we come to it. But I can only presume that given what's gone on, and anyway, from a Waterford perspective anyway, when it comes to our time to stand up for what's right, we'll be firmly standing with the fact that we want to be wearing shorts and given a choice.
Okay, you mentioned you've a rest week, well, not a rest weekend, a bye weekend this weekend ahead of playing the weekend after away to Kilkenny. So we've got Galway, Dublin, Derry, Kilkenny in Group 2 this weekend, Cork, Limerick, Clare, Wexford in Group 1. Like, we should be talking about the fact that we're on the eve of the main competition, and we should be talking about the fact that it's been another really strong year for the sport so far, and a championship that you would think is wide open.
Yeah, look, you know, that's what the thing is about it, like, you know, and there's been some great matches over the league campaign, over the provincial campaign, and it's a sad thing that we're talking about now whether we'll be allowed to wear shorts or skirts on it, but there is a great host of games the weekend. It's the kicking off of our championship season. It's a bit later than the men's ones. You know, when you're looking at the men's playing and they're nearly coming towards the end of their round robin series, we're always kicking off a little bit after. But there's a great host of games. The All Ireland champions, Cork will be in host, and you know, Kilkenny going up to Derry. So there's all to play for, and I suppose each team, I suppose the first week of games, each team's in with a shout.
Yeah, I know the cliche will be that Waterford's aim will be to get out of the group and maybe progress beyond the quarterfinals as you did last year. You're probably not going to give me much in terms of what your expectations are for the year ahead.
No, I think that'll be telling. I'll talk about the skirts for as long as you want in the shorts, but revealing what's inside camp, I think that I wouldn't be allowed to go training if that was the case, Damien. So
Okay.
I'll keep it in house for a while and
Listen.
leave the results speak for
Yeah,
themselves.
I don't want to get you into any more trouble than you might feel you're in already. Niamh, listen, I greatly appreciate you taking the call as you head towards training. And listen, no, we'll let the democratic process play out tonight, and no doubt we'll chat between now and championships end again. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mel. Thanks, Mel.
That's Waterford's Niamh Rockett chatting to us. So I'm told in or around 8:15, 8:30 tonight, we should have some word or white smoke from Croke Park. And people on the ground seem to think it could be passed and could be passed with relative ease. That's the latest we're hearing. So we'll wait and see how all that plays out. And we are hoping to hear from Brian Molloy, the president of the Camogie Association, before the end of the programme. We're going to chat cycling after the break. Stay with us.
This is 2FM's Game On.
It certainly is. We're going to chat cycling next on the programme. Ross Talchin underway since yesterday. Stage two concluded earlier today. Shane Stokes, cycling journalist, is with us. Hiya, Shane.
Hi, Damien. How are you?
Not too bad. Good to talk to you as always. Before we talk about the nuts and bolts of how things are progressing so far, the 70th edition of the race, and we should remind ourselves that this is an institution of Irish sport and a very, very important couple of days for the cycling community in this country.
Absolutely, yeah. You have the national championships on, of course, each year, but I'd say this is the prime event, and the Rossamman for the women, so that the two standout events, because you get an international field coming over, and because, as you say, 70 editions, so there's a whole lot of history and a whole lot of prestige to it. It's quite legendary worldwide for the type of race it is.
Yeah, it's because that's the thing that might intrigue some people, is that for now, listen, we do have a cycling heritage and we do have people that compete on the world stage on a great level, but like this is a race that does attract an awful lot of international interest.
It really does. And part of the magic of it, and Dermot Dignam, the former race organiser, and Ger Campbell, the current race organiser, would underline the value of the county riders. So, you know, the guys that are going out and working and then training in the evenings and doing the Ross. And what's great about that is that you've got roughly half the field is comprised of those riders. And it leads to a really chaotic racing because the professional fields full of professional riders have a sort of a logic to it. Whereas this mix of the county guys and then the internationals and the overseas riders, there's no logic. It's really anything could happen and everything does happen. So it makes for a really difficult race, very hard to control and very, very unpredictable.
Okay, so we'd 170 kilometre stage two today, and for the second day running, a UK winner of the stage.
Yeah, that's right. A rider called Will Perrott from the Das Richardson's team jumped away. He was part of a 20-man group who attacked inside the last 4 kilometres and held on to win the stage. He finished 6 seconds clear of another Briton, Josh Charlton. And then there was an Irish rider, Oran Dugan, in third from Cycling Ulster. He picked up 6 seconds in time bonus yesterday, and with the first two riders on yesterday's stage missing out, it ended up that Oran takes the overall lead. Now, he told me yesterday that he didn't expect to go for the overall, that he was up for stages, but hey presto, he's in the yellow jersey for the first time in his career, so he was understandably delighted with that.
We'll hear from him in a second, but let's hear from Will Perrott, the stage winner today, who's been reflecting on how the day's business went for him.
Yeah, it was a tough final finish, and then with 4k to go, I chipped off and I went really hard up this drag that I didn't really know about, but looked behind and managed to get a gap, and then that was it. I was all in. Once you've done that, there's no point waiting for the sprint because you've already spent your final bullet. So it was actually a really tough like headwind at the end, and I That was, yeah, that was pretty grim. But thankfully, just tucked in, went full gas, and managed to hold off to the line.
That's Will Parrott chatting to you earlier, Shane. And then, like, for Oran Dugan, like, I appreciate it's early stages and an awful lot can happen between now and the race concluding in a couple of days' time. But, you know, it's a brilliant career landmark to say you were in the yellow jersey in Ross Talchin when you're a domestic rider.
Yeah, absolutely. He's 21. And when he was 18, he rode the race the first time. And from memory, he finished second on the stage at 18 years of age. So I think it was second rather than third. So it was second, which is an incredible result for a rider so young. And he's really just confirmed that talent in the last couple of days. So he was in that break yesterday and he was still strong enough to sprint at the end. And is in the race lead now. And yeah, now he's talking about waiting to see how things go and could he win overall. So it'll be interesting. He's 3 seconds clear of the Irish-based Italian Matteo Segala, who's a regular on the Ross and is always there for trying for stage wins, hasn't yet taken a stage win, but he's in second overall to his own surprise as well. So the first two overall didn't expect to be where they are, but there they are.
Okay, let's hear from Oran. As mentioned, was targeting a couple of stage victories perhaps, but not necessarily the lead in general classification.
It's quite funny, to be honest. I didn't expect it at all. Yesterday was probably the best chance for a stage win, and today I was just going to try my hardest, I think. I went a bit too hard at the start, got a bit carried away and rode a bit too hard. So yeah, in the middle, that's where I kind of pulled myself back a bit, recovered a bit, and then realised the end of group actually nipped off up the road. So then I started riding again and found myself back at the front of the race, and just so happened that I got into yellow.
What's that feeling like then when you're confirmed as the race leader of this race?
Unbelievable, incredible. Like, I didn't actually believe it when I heard it until, yeah, I got called down saying I was in yellow.
Sure. You're in the points jersey as well, and you're the best under 23 rider, so you've almost a clean sweep. Just the mountains jersey is the only one that's on somebody else's shoulders.
Yeah, I'd be pretty happy with just the yellow, but the rest is just a bonus, I suppose.
And what are your thoughts? There's 3 stages left. What are your thoughts for those days ahead?
Yeah, just ride as good as I can, take it day by day, and that's all I can do, really.
And obviously try and keep yellow.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, try and keep yellow.
Yeah, we wish him well with that. So, Shane, we had Charlestown to Clifton today, Cong to Milltown Malbay tomorrow, Ennis to Mount Rath the day after, and then Kildare Town to Bective to conclude the whole thing. Like, listen, we're two-fifths of the way through it, but a couple of big challenges still to come for the peloton, and the destination of this race win, it's far from being decided.
Absolutely, and this race is one that almost always sees unexpected occurrences happening. Riders have learned early on and not won overall. So it's very much up in the air, and that's what makes it so suspenseful and so entertaining.
Okay. Shane, safe travels around the country. Thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you.
That's Shane Stokes with us there. So if you're out and about Milltown, anywhere between Cong and Milltown Malbay, Ennis and Mount Rath, and Kildare Town and Bective, get out and cheer them on. Keith Tracy is with me. Do you remember the days when the old Tour of Ireland used to go around Howth Hill and down through Sutton? And you don't know, see, maybe I'm showing my age on you, but I remember being frog marched as a young fella out to Sutton Cross, where the Grand Hotel is in Sutton, and roaring at Sean Kelly. We were a Sean Kelly household.
I think we had two very different upbringings.
Yeah,
there.
But you see, you know, like, Sean Kelly's from Carrick-on-Shore, and Waterford people and Tipperary people would row over him. So I'm a Tipperary household. So Sean Kelly was God in our house. You'd have been afraid to tell your father you were a Stephen Roach fan back in our house back in the day. So anyway, there are the memories. No memories for Man United fans last night. Loads of memories for Spurs fans. When we reflect more on that final last night, the body language and a lot of the messaging to come out of the Man United camp after it is probably more telling than anything else. And there's almost multiple appeals to the board and multiple appeals to management at the club. Please release me from the misery that I'm enduring here.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of the interviews. You understand that the Manchester United players will be as low as a snake's belly and you get a mic thrown in front of them, but I was particularly disappointed in the way Bruno Fernandes spoke after the game, saying, look, if they want to cash in on me and you know, use the money for a revamp of the club, if they don't want me here, I'll leave. That's the captain. That's somebody who should be saying, look, behind closed doors, if he wants to have a meeting with the big wigs and say that's no problem, but he's got to relay the message to the fans that I'm the captain and I'm going to keep this, or try to get the club going in the right direction. And look, I honestly thought, I said last night that there isn't a world where Bruno Fernandes doesn't play well and Manchester United win this final. And he was a million miles off it. Look, it was touch tackle in the middle of the pitch. He was never going to get an awful lot of time or to be able to pull the strings out there. But you look at the likes of Mason Mount, only really back from injury. I think he's played 13 games this season. So if you're Garnacho, you can understand why that's left a real sour taste in the mouth. Luke Shaw has only played 9 games this season. So look, it wasn't a full-strength Manchester United team. But again, Spurs fans will be saying that they didn't have Maddison, they didn't have Kulusevski, they didn't have Bergwijn. Son started on the bench. So I think Spurs just seemed to want it that little bit more. There was very little class within the game, but Spurs just seemed to, as I say, just wanted it that bit more.
When you're a player, how quickly do you realise that on the field of play, that, you know, these lads aren't up for this at all tonight?
It becomes pretty evident really quickly. And look, on the evidence of last night, for the first 10, maybe 15 minutes, United were okay. They were competitive. They were probably shading the game. But I thought Spurs became more and more comfortable without possession. And that's something that I haven't been able to say about Tottenham Hotspur this season. But once they scored the goal, you know, the Brennan Johnson goal probably summed up the game. The Manchester United defending is awful. As Papasar decides he's about to cross the ball, Mazraoui is 2-3 yards off him, and he doesn't try to stop the ball coming into the box. So that's mistake number one. Mistake number two is Harry Maguire can deal with the ball, but he sees Solanke and he thinks, well, I'll just get hold of Solanke, and if he doesn't score, I've done my job. That's not good enough for the centre half. He doesn't know what's behind him. And obviously Brennan Johnson nicks in, and I think he makes a hash of the force when it pops back up, hits Luke Shaw, and he manages to bundle it over the line there. So Shaw was off it, Maguire was off it, Onana should have reacted better, and Mazraoui should have done an awful lot better stopping the cross coming in. And yet I imagine that's where my criticism comes of Bruno Fernandes. When you're in the trenches, when things aren't going well, is the captain going to get the boat going in the right direction? And for me, Bruno Fernandes didn't have any of that last night. Just went missing like everybody else.
I'm conscious that Spurs won and we're talking a lot about Man United, so we will come to Spurs in a second. But just to develop that point about the messaging, even for the manager afterwards to come out and say, listen, if they don't want me, I'll be gone. I'm not looking for compensation. I'm paraphrasing, but I'll be out the gap if the board make it evident to me that I'm not wanted here. Like, you can admire his honesty in a way, or equally you can question where is his head at with regard to his own ability to turn around what is a cultural disaster.
Yeah, it just doesn't sound right, does it? And again, obviously Manchester United haven't made the Champions League, so you'd imagine the transfer market this season will be quite dire for them. And the fact that, you know, somebody, one of the bigger players within Europe, might be thinking, do you know what, I like Manchester United, I like Ruben Amorim, I'll sign for Manchester United. And when you hear Bruno Fernandes being as flaky as he is about staying, Ruben Amorim being as flaky as he is about staying, it would just put you off of going to that club. I don't think any agent in European football and world football would be telling their players, go and sign for Manchester United. So yeah, I don't think it's the best thing in the world, but I think Ruben Amorim is just trying to be straight down the line with everybody. He's trying to be honest, but sometimes there's no place for honesty in football at times.
When you look at Spurs, is their league position a fair reflection of where that squad has been at, or do we need to be very honest and say for quite some time now their season has been built around Europa League or bust?
Yeah, you could say that about both teams. I think Manchester United had one eye on the final. Spurs have definitely had one eye on the final. But I understand it a little bit more from Spurs' point of view. They've had so many injuries. And even, 2 weeks ago, they put Kulusevski out when he ended up doing his knee. And you just think, Ange can't catch a break here. And he was very vocal in saying he's going to wrap all of his players up in open cotton wool. But look, I thought it was brilliant when Harry Maguire went up front in the dying embers of the game, him and Christian Romero going a little bit tit for tat. I thought that was great. Gives us a little insight into possibly an Argentina and England World Cup game and next year. So look, I thought Spurs were good. I thought they played the conditions really, really well. The clearance off the line from Mickey van de Ven, the go-go gadget hamstring, was really good. But that was as close as Manchester United got. And I think in hindsight, I would have started Kobbie Mainoo ahead of Casemiro, and I would have started Garnacho ahead of Mason Mount. And hindsight's a wonderful thing, but I'm never one for, you know, players tweeting and giving out, especially in the build-up to a game. But the way Garnacho went about it is not something that will live well in the dressing room.
It's hard to see Spurs being overly competitive in the Champions League based on their league performance this year. But how much of a boost can this give them? How much of a refocus can it give them for next season?
I'm not too sure. I think when you look at the Premier League, they've obviously lost 21 games out of 38. You know, that's nowhere near good enough. And, you know, people are saying to me, Spurs are an elite club within England. If you're an elite club within England, you don't just go for one trophy. You've got to compete on all fronts, and they've been a million miles off. They got knocked out of the FA Cup fairly early on. They were non-existent in the Premier League, and Spurs have become the lowest placed team to ever win a European trophy. And I know Spurs fans would be like a water off a duck's back. They won't care less. They've won a trophy, but, you know, I even Ange after the game said it wouldn't have made a difference if Spurs finished third and won this trophy. It would have made a big, big difference, because then you're competing on two fronts. You've guaranteed Champions League football because of your domestic capabilities. But either way, they've snuck in the back door, and like I say, I don't think Spurs fans will care whatsoever.
Daniel Levy has shown an interesting approach to running a football club, and he will have no problem getting rid of Ange Postecoglou if he thinks it's the right thing for the club, or if he thinks it's the easiest thing for him to stay on side of the fans. Do you expect Ange to be in charge for the first Premier League game of next season?
I really don't. I think he's had enough, more so. I think Spurs fans are probably happy enough to see him stay there because of what he's done, but in terms of the league, I think with the way he's been treated, with some of the questions, the hero or clown comments, I just think he's has a bit of a pain in his neck with it now. But, you know, when you're in that dressing room last night and the champagne is flowing, you've got a medal around your neck, maybe the feelings have changed ever so slightly. I'm not sure what Spurs fans will think, but I feel like Ange has had enough, to be honest.
But the problem is, not quite to the same extent as Manchester United, but you've now got a revolving door of managers who've gone into that club. He's ultimately the one who's ended a 17-year wait for silverware. He's done what he said he would do. You kind of question how is it perceived in terms of a management job?
Look, it's obviously a success. He's won a trophy, but Oliver Glasner's won a trophy with Crystal Palace as well. So, you know, it's difficult. You know, it is really, really difficult. Domestically, Spurs are a million miles off, and that's where the bread and butter is. That's where you've got to prove that you're able to compete. But look, defensively, I do think there's been a bit of evolution within Ange Postecoglou's Spurs team. Obviously, they were play at all costs, don't really worry about defending, stand on the halfway line with a ridiculously high line, kamikaze defending. But over the last couple of months, I think with injuries and everything else, and the criticism that Ange has taken from set pieces, they've become a little bit more solid. Out possession in the second 45 minutes last night, Damien, they had an XG of 0.00 Spurs, 17% of the ball, no shots on target. They attempted 80 passes in 45 minutes and completed 40 of them. That's a Spurs team that thought, we're not messing around here. Yeah. We're just bypassing our midfield. And I totally understand it. If Maddison and Kulusevski were in the middle of the pitch, then possibly you could say Ange shouldn't have done that. He has the players to play. But I don't think he did. With Papasarde as a young player, getting better all the time, Bissoum is more of a disruptor in my mind. And Bentancur is a wonderful player. But one thing I didn't want is too many sideways or backwards passes. And like I say, I thought Spurs just played the conditions that little bit more and wanted it a bit more.
Okay, so we've the culmination of the Premier League this year. Thankfully, we've got the League of Ireland to keep us entertained over the summer months. It's a kind of a limp finish to the Premier League this weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, it will be. I think the big one is the Nottingham Forest game. Maybe they can nick Champions League football. There's slim hopes there, but look, I think Nottingham Forest have been brilliant this season. I think if there's any neutrals out there with the Spurs and the Forest and Chelsea game, it's, you know, Forest have become my second team. Out of possession, you know, so much of modern football is get the ball down, be nice and neat, play through the towards, all of this sort of stuff. Nottingham Forest do the complete opposite of that. They let you have the ball. When they win it, they get it to Gibbs White. If you cover him up, they get it to Alanga, they get it to Hudson-Odoi. And if somehow you get a blanket on the middle and you're engaging in the wings, they'll go back the front up to Chris Wood and they'll win the second balls from there. So I love how they're doing it. I'm delighted for Nuno Espirito Santos. Done really well at Wolves, come into Spurs, as you've just said, a whole host of managers, didn't go quite well, but went into Nottingham Forest, and he's been absolutely exceptional. And I would love for Nottingham Forest to get Champions League football.
If we were doing the Tracys as the end of season awards, Nuno for manager of the year ahead of Ange, or not Ange, Arne Slot? Or go on, throw me a different. If there's a curveball, throw me a curveball.
Well, no, I think Nuno would be there or thereabouts. I think there's been some really good. Like David Moyes, I know he didn't have a whole season there, but everything looked like they were in a little bit of trouble when Sean Dyche went out. But David Moyes has just eased them away from that. Yeah, Nuno Espirito Santos at Wolves, I think, has been excellent. Slot, I have to say, I was convinced there would be a Jurgen Klopp hangover. The fact that that hasn't happened, I put that down to Arne Slot, and he's put his ego to one side. He didn't try and reinvent the wheel. The team that Klopp left, he only signed Federico Chiesa, and he didn't play an awful lot of football this season. So it was Klopp's team, but he put his ego to one side and said, that's good enough for me. Just a few tactical tweaks here or there. Yeah, even Arne Slot, Nuno Espirito Santos, I think the Chelsea manager, his name escapes me now, Macaresca, I think he's done quite a good job as well. I've used words like unmanageable and chaotic.
He's another one who could well be gone before the start of next season.
Yeah, but there's such a high turnover. I'm hearing Chelsea being linked with Garnacho, the Manchester United player, and you think they don't need another winger, they don't need another player just running on top. And so, like, you look at football now and so many people think, well, just sign good players and throw them out on the pitch. It takes a whole lot of attitudes and different personalities to make a team work. It's not just about talent, throw them out there and let them go at it as they please.
So let me bring you back then to finish to your days when you were a member of the PFA and you voted on your player of the season. Or did you ever bother actually filling in the forms?
No, not particularly.
Yeah, no. Very few players do. So you're player of the season if you were to go for one this year.
Player of the season, I've really enjoyed Gravenberch. I think you could probably say anything about the...
But come here, doesn't Gravenberch show you the sliding door moments? You talk about Chiesa coming in. Like, they wanted Zubimendi, didn't happen. They got stuck with Gravenberch in this new position and he's ended up being the revelation of all revelations.
Yeah, but look, I wouldn't say Gravenberch was the out-and-out number six all of the time. It's Szoboszlai, McAllister. The three of them dovetailed really well. If one went forward, the other one would stay. And the three of them between them have created a number six. Even little McAllister, he's a wonderful technician. I love him seeing him play further up the pitch. But when he does play in that number six, he puts his foot in, he wins the ball back, as does Szoboszlai, as does Gravenberch. But I find it very hard to look past Mo Salah.
Okay.
I think he's been outstanding.
Very few people who disagree with that. Keith, thank you for your company.
Cheers, Damon.
As always, Keith Tracy with us. You'll hear plenty of Keith as the League of Ireland season rolls on over the summer months. We've got much more still to come in the programme. We're hoping to hear from the Camogie Association President, Brian Malloy, shortly, but certainly after the break, we're going to hear from Shep.
Game on. Eye on America.
So all of that to come. We're 11 minutes or so away from the new music show with Betta, but before that, we're going to go to the States. Shep is with us. Hiya, Shep.
Hey, Damien, how you doing, buddy?
Not too bad. Good to talk to you, as always. I love the terminology. I love the sanctity of American sport. And let's begin tonight by celebrating the fact that the Tush Push has survived.
Yes, I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, Damien. So there was discussion going on amongst some NFL owners. The Green Bay Packers actually introduced a proposal to ban a play, what has affectionately been come to be known as the Tush Push, as you say. And it's basically, you know, the quarterback runs right up behind the rear end of his center and, you know, gets a little maybe push from the running back as well. And it failed, thankfully, I think. Thankfully, it failed. At the owners' meeting, they needed 24 votes for it to pass, and they got 22. Look, Damien, the thing is this, it can be used by all 32 teams. It's just the Eagles have really perfected it, you know, and with Jalen Hurts running behind Jason Kelce. And as a matter of fact, the Eagles owner, Jeffrey Lurie, brought Jason Kelce with him to the meetings so he could dispel any rumors or discussions about, you know, people getting hurt on the play. Kelce said, hey, I'll come out of retirement tomorrow if that's the only play we get to run. He said, it's great. So...
okay, we've an issue with the line, but we're going to stick with it. But I know it's the Tush Push, or it's known as the Brotherly Shove. But like it doesn't appear to be that. Is it like how contentious a play is it? Like how risk averse do you have to be in order to want this eliminated or eradicated from the game?
I'll be honest with you. I mean, look, all the other teams in the league are like, well, hell, why do they do it so successfully? Why can't we do it? You know, I mean, it's more jealousy, I think, than anything else, you know. I hadn't really heard of anybody really being that upset about it until the Packers, you know, filed their proposal. But look, Damien, and I'll yield to you on this one. The chair of the competition committee said, is this more of a rugby play than it is a football play, you know? So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I mean, and is it a bad idea to keep it out of the game if it is more of a rugby play? I don't know. I just think it's an innovation in the game of football, which I don't know why we would be against that.
But I think the equivalent in rugby is like a line out 5 metres out from the line and you win your ball and then everyone bails in to try and push the player in possession over the field. But the issue is in American football, because of the added equipment that the players wear, you weaponize your body a little bit more. So maybe there's a greater risk in that regard.
So they you know, you can't do it in college football. They outlawed it a couple of years ago. There was a famous play between, you know, USC and Notre Dame, I don't know, 15 or 20 some years ago, where USC ran into some success in South Bend. And they kind of, you know, pretty much banned it ever since then. But you can still do it in the NFL. And so, you know, I don't necessarily think it's a loophole. It's not like they're taking advantage. To me, they're not taking advantage of some law that, you know, oh, no, they figured a way around it. I just think they're running a football play that people are having a hard time stopping. And for some reason, everybody else is losing their minds over it. And it's just not normally how things go in the world of sports, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, listen, we'll wait and see. In sporting matters, we spoke a couple of weeks back, you and I, about injuries overshadowing the NBA playoffs, but the basketball is well and truly dominating the headlines now, and the business end of the season is really just a matter of days away.
Yeah, we're down to the final four teams. You know, the Knicks beat the Celtics, who you mentioned the injury. You know, Jason Tatum had gotten hurt. But the Knicks were up 14 points last night with seven or eight minutes to go in the game. And the Indiana Pacers just staged an all-time comeback. They scored 23 points in the last 3 minutes and 15 seconds, which is the most ever in the playoffs. And they force overtime on an incredible last-second shot by Tyrese Halliburton. And then they go and win it and kind of shocked the Knicks in game one. The Pacers are just kind of, you know, proven to be hard to kill here on the road in New York at Madison Square Garden. So they get game one. And then over on the Western Conference, you know, Oklahoma City, no issues after game one against Minnesota. They won 114-88, just destroyed them. You know, you got to think Damian Rust might have been a factor there. The Thunder had just played 2 days before, or the Timberwolves were off for a week before that. So just played poorly, didn't shoot well. Anthony Edwards didn't have a good game. And, you know, SGA, the who plays for the Thunder, you know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he goes and wins the MVP award also, you know, this week. He won the scoring title. They won 68 games. I mean, look, they're the best team in the league. He's the best player on the best team. So, you know, it makes sense that he wins the MVP. So Minnesota's really going to have to turn things around quick tonight in game two.
Yeah, and it's a reminder as well that, you know, the seedings count for very little. Like, I think, I know the Celtics won last year as top seeds, but beat the team that was fifth seeds on the other side of the division. But you've Indiana and New York, third and fourth. You've, I suppose, are Oklahoma and City, who were top seeds on the Western Conference. They're realistically, based on form, the team that everyone's going to have to beat.
That's exactly right. Yeah, 68 wins, league best. They're the overall number one seed, best player. You know, they've just been the best ones to watch all season. So, yeah, they're holding to form out west.
Okay, we'll wait and see how it plays out. Shep, thanks so much for being with us, as always. Look after yourself. Chat to you next week.
All right, thanks, Damien.
That's Shep with us from the States, bringing the program nearly to a conclusion. We heard earlier from Waterford's Niamh Rockett a very open interview, very interesting listen with regard to the votes on the Scort or the Short, which will take place at Croke Park. Delegates assembling at Croke Park. Amongst those present is the president of the Camogie Association, Brian Malloy. He's been chatting a short time ago to Marty Morrissey.
Brian, the last couple of weeks have been very difficult for the Camogie Association, but what has been happening behind the scenes in terms of the special Congress tonight?
Marty, it's great to be here. It's great to be here in Croke Park always for our special Congress. The last couple of weeks, I've been engaged with the delegates, the county chairs, the provincial chairs, delegates from all across the country. We have 94,000 playing members, and they have been engaged with. That's one thing I can guarantee, because I've spoken to all of the different county chairs and provincial chairs to make sure that they have been engaging with their members and engaging with their players, and to make sure that the players' voice is heard this evening. And that is going to happen.
There's only one motion on the floor, but I think there's about 136 delegates, which, if you go with the two-thirds majority, means 91 have to vote in favour of giving the players choice. Do you think that's going to happen tonight?
It's impossible for me to say, and it's really, and I said it before, it's not my role to tell delegates how to vote. Delegates speak to their members, speak to their players, and find out what their members and what their players want, and then they represent them up here. It's representative democracy. What I can tell you is they have spoken to them, they have listened to them, and they are going to represent them perfectly up here this evening. And I'm looking forward to Special Congress, and I'm hopeful that the result will be in favour of choice. But I can't say how it will go.
Brian Malloy, thank you very much for joining us on the 6-1 News. And of course, if it is passed tonight, then it will become law as such, and the players will have the choice of skirts or shorts from this weekend on.
That's Marty with Brian Molloy at Croke Park. We're told 8.15, 8.30 this evening there could well be a resolution. No doubt details of it on the RT Sport website, the RT News app, and no doubt as well radio bulletins across Radio 1, 2FM and the 9 o'clock news on television this evening. That brings the programme to a conclusion. Bet is on the way shortly. Jenny's here after 9. Dan's here after 11. Our broadcast coordinator tonight, Laura Lee Davies. The programme produced by Andrew O'Connor from Damien O'Mara, all of us here till tomorrow night at 6. Good night.
This is 2FM.